I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.
Most of you know, last week I offered a talk in here in honor of Thanksgiving week on the topic of gratitude. And afterwards, when I was done, when I was driving home, it occurred to me that I hope that I had also expressed the idea that when we're practicing gratitude, it doesn't at all mean that we are covering over or sugarcoating any of the negative emotions with this practice. I want to make that really clear. Gratitude practice is really meant as a kind of training to help us discover what the Buddha called the middle way, so that when we're faced with the inevitable pain of life that comes with being alive in this world, we're going to be better able to meet it with more of a sense of balance and equanimity. And so tonight, I thought that in contrast a little bit, that I would talk about how we can open our hearts up to sadness, how we can do that, and why it's important. And so to start with, I wanted to offer you some images that might be helpful. Has anybody seen how many of you have seen the Pixar movie Inside Out? Show of hands. Oh, okay, so not as many of you than I thought. So if you haven't seen it, it's fantastic. It's called Inside Out. It's by Pixar. It's a children's movie, a film, and came out a few years ago, and all the mindfulness communities were talking about this film, and it's pretty wonderful. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's about this 11-year-old girl named Riley who is experiencing a bit of a life crisis. Her parents have decided that they're going to move, the three of them, from Minnesota, you can imagine, all the way to San Francisco. And most of the movie is set inside Riley's brain. And the lead characters are the emotions. So there's joy, sadness, anger, fear, and disgust. And they are all battling to control the heroine's responses through this control panel in her brain. And so when Riley's crisis is triggered by the move, joy and sadness get lost. They get lost deep within the subconscious. This is the storyline. And fear, anger, and disgust take over. Isn't that interesting? And so I thought that this in itself was a pretty accurate description of what can happen when there's a kind of a crisis in our lives. You know, joy and sadness both tend to get lost, and fear and anger and disgust or judgment and aversion tend to take over, right? And I also love the fact, this might be helpful to know, that the directors of this movie consulted leading neuroscientists all over the world so that they could more accurately teach children about their emotions and their memories and the inner workings of their brains. So you really need to see this movie if you haven't seen it. So the stars of this movie then, interestingly, it's not really Riley, the stars of the movie are joy and sadness, who are in essence partners. And if you want to Google these, if you haven't seen them, the characters are really adorable. So Joy has these big, huge eyes and a bright green dress and a literal glow around her. And she's constantly raising her arms and leaping and dancing with joy. This is Joy. Sadness, I think, is even more adorable. She's short, and she's got these big, dark glasses. And, of course, she's all blue because she's sadness. And she tends to fall flat on her face. She just plops over whenever Joy wants her to do anything. And so while sadness is flat on her face, she'll say things like, "I'm too sad to walk. Just give me a few hours." Or, "Crying helps me slow down and obsess over the weight of life's problems. She's really cute. Meanwhile, for the most of the movie, Joy is busy trying to make Sadness happy, which of course isn't working. It never does. And so Joy is often shown rolling her eyes at Sadness and generally just being completely annoyed with Sadness. Joy is also constantly trying to keep Sadness away from these big glowing globes that represent Riley's core memories from her childhood, these globes. And this is because when she touches one of these globes, they tend to turn blue. So it makes them sad, okay? So Joy is really obsessed with keeping Sadness away from Riley's memories. That's her main job. Because this is she considers this her main job, she even goes as far as to draw a circle on the floor, and she makes Sadness stand in what she calls the circle of sadness. She literally puts a boundary around her, around Sadness. And eventually, of course, though, Sadness does manage to pick up one of the globes, and when Joy snatches it away from her, Sadness pouts, and she apologizes. And she says quietly to Joy, "I wanted to maybe hold one. I wanted to maybe hold one." And it just, when I heard that, it just brought tears to my eyes. And I just found that was so tender and just truly profound. So I won't totally ruin it for those of you who haven't seen it, I hope. But at the end of the movie, we're shown that basically it is normal for Riley to feel sad about something big in her life that was happening. And in this case, it's moving away and losing all her old friends and the home that she's grown up in, all of these things. It's normal. It was normal for her to feel angry and pissed about having no say in it. She has no say in it, you know? And it was normal for her to feel fear, of course, when she's confronted with a new situation. Anybody in here move? Right? That's scary, especially when you're a kid. Man, it's scary even as an adult. But as a kid, you can imagine how scary that is. So it's normal. Roger Ebert, the movie critic, summarized the movie very simply. He said, "This movie is just saying, listen to sadness. Listen to sadness. Sadness is important. Sadness has something to teach you. It stands in opposition to an entire culture that tells people that happiness is the highest, best, and sometimes only permissible emotion, and that sadness is an obstacle to being happy, and that we should concentrate all of our emotional and cultural energy on trying to eradicate sadness so that everyone can be happy." Right? He goes on to say that he believes that so much of this is a kind of cultural pressure that creates in us a kind of an insecurity about our own sadness. Right? Don't we all have a little bit? The Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa and other spiritual teachers all over the world have commented about our particular American society and about how they have not witnessed so much self-criticism on any other place in the world. Isn't that interesting? Any other place but here. This is what we're swimming in. And I really believe this is because of exactly what Roger Ebert was pointing to, that we are culturally conditioned, especially through the media, to believe that if we're not constantly happy and perfect, that something is somehow wrong with us. There's something wrong with us. And we should also somehow, because of this, we should be ashamed of it. We should be ashamed in some way of sadness, right? We might even find ourselves experiencing real discomfort when someone tells us that they're feeling sad about something, because we're all supposed to be happy. So that's really uncomfortable. And so very often, instead of listening and offering empathy, we might find ourselves offering advice about how we think that person can quote-unquote fix their sadness, or maybe eliminate it or make it stop or go away, right? We tend to almost automatically believe that whatever it is, it's not right. In some way, it shouldn't be happening, right? So in truth, what's often making us uncomfortable in these situations is not the sadness itself, but our perception of what's happening. Not the sadness, but our perception of what's happening. My favorite Buddhist nun, as most of you know, is Pema Chodron, and she speaks about this kind of uncomfortableness this way. She says, the only reason we don't open our hearts and minds to other people is that they trigger confusion in us that we don't feel brave enough or sane enough to deal with. To the degree that we look clearly and compassionately at ourselves, we feel confident and fearless about looking into someone else's eyes. Okay. What's also true is that many of us, of course, tend to do the same thing to ourselves that we do with others when we're relating to sadness. It's like we have this kind of unconscious voice inside our own heads, just like that Joy character in the movie who's telling us to cheer up, right? Get over it. Buck up or buckle up. Just stop being sad, you know? You might even think about all the names we might call ourselves when we're feeling sad, all the labels we might put on ourselves. Think about it. What do you say to yourself when you're sad? You're pathetic. You're a loser. You're just such a big baby, right? You're a snowflake, whatever it is. Stop being sad. We might hear ourselves saying things like, what is wrong with you? Right? You ever hear that when you're sad? What's wrong with you? Why are you so sad? Something's wrong. Doesn't it feel wrong? Right? Or you should really be over this already. You should be over this already. What's wrong with you? Get a grip. All those phrases that we use. We might even think we've somehow failed in our quest to be constantly happy when we're sad. I've failed in some way. I'm sad. What did I do wrong? I must have failed. All of that being said, not trying to push away or reject sadness is actually an ongoing practice, really, for all of us, isn't it? It's an ongoing practice. As the Buddha taught, it is our very natural, habitual tendency to not want to be with our sadness, to want to run away from it or cover it over or just somehow make it go away. And yet the interesting paradox is that when we don't allow or acknowledge sadness, what happens is that it can actually turn into depression because we're turning it inward instead of letting it out. We tend to turn it inside and identify with it, right, rather than letting it naturally flow out. So when we're rejecting sadness, not allowing it, we're in essence, interestingly, locking it in, right? Just as effectively as Joy did in the movie when she drew a boundary around sadness, right? And we can actually be very angry at our sadness sometimes, can't we? Right? Get really angry. Why am I so sad? When I was teaching the mindfulness-based stress reduction workshops, near the end, I would often offer a guided loving-kindness meditation that begins with asking students to get in touch with a kind of hurt or grief or sadness that they've been experiencing. And of course, this is always the last class. This is the hardest thing to do. You don't want to start out with that. People leave. We'll come back, you know. So I end with that, and some people tend to cry during this particular practice, but one time a young woman shared that what she kept seeing was walls, literal walls, being thrown up, and she felt super angry, like rageful at her sadness. She didn't want to experience it at all. Don't really want to touch that. And as she was speaking about this, I invited her to actually hold her resistance with kindness, right? To see the walls and hold the resistance with kindness, because that was what was there. That's what she was experiencing, right? And I've said this before, you just work with what's there. Don't try to break through it. You work with that. And that was what she was experiencing in the moment, and that needed attention. The resistance itself needed her awareness and her attention. It was really okay. And what happened is that as she was able to see and honor even her resistance, suddenly there was a flood of tears, you know. And after class, of course, she let me know that the tears actually felt really good. And it was a huge, felt like a huge relief to finally allow herself to experience and express her sadness. Crying is incredibly healing. Allowing your sadness is what we need to heal. It's like the blood over the wound, you know, it helps it to heal. I wanted to share this piece from you from Emily Herslin, who's a meditation teacher in New York City, who wrote about how she was able to hold the sadness she felt in November of 2015 during the attacks in Paris. Okay, so this is a little longer, but it really spoke to me. She wrote, "It's a difficult weekend. There have been tragedies in our world. Some of us may be feeling angry, sad, confused. All of these feelings are allowed to be here. One way I sometimes tend to react to tragedy is to immerse myself in information, TV coverage, Twitter, all the articles my friends are sharing on Facebook. A friend wrote to me that he's been rewatching the news coverage of the attacks over and over, and it's echoing for him the way he reacted to 9/11. I'm not sure it's possible to avoid this association, this remembrance, because it's here already, at least for me, so I'm not going to try. I remember obsessively watching the 9/11 news coverage, as so many of us did, trying to make sense of what was happening, trying to get rid of the confusion. I remember I was overwhelmed by sadness. I had a doctor who was kind of a mentor to me, and I emailed him asking him, what should I do with my sadness? How could I stop feeling so sad? He suggested I turn off the TV, take a box, put objects in it that represented my sadness, and put the box in a closet. So I did. I turned off the TV. I took an old shoe box and put in some pennies, a little elephant figurine, a folded up tissue, a seashell. I named them all sadness and put them in a box and put the box in my closet. Strangely, it helped. It didn't make my sadness go away, but it felt more manageable and not as unwieldy. I don't think it was a process of putting the box away in the closet. I think it was the process of naming sadness, of touching it, holding it in my hands, in my body, being with it. It was something I could be familiar with, and it wasn't dangerous. It was safe to hold this feeling. I think that our meditation practice can give us something similar. It gives us permission to name what's here, to hold it, to touch it. It gives us the ability to see what we are capable of holding in our hearts. It teaches us to be kind to our experience in this way, to give our experience the caring attention that we might give a friend. We can see that it is not the enemy. Okay. So I love that story. And it reminded me of a quote I love from the Buddha, who said, "Our sorrows and our wounds are healed only when we touch them with compassion. Our sorrows and wounds are healed only when we touch them with compassion." So just like all the other emotions, the Buddha taught us that the way to get through or past sadness is actually to get to know sadness. So he asks us to become intimate with sadness, to experience what sadness feels like, so that it doesn't totally confuse or overwhelm us or frustrate us when it arrives, when we see it, when it visits, you know. So we're not so afraid of sadness that we're locking it into that circle of sadness because we're familiar with sadness. Through our practice, we also begin to see and recognize and know the truth of the fact that sadness is simply a visitor, right? She's just a visitor, or he's just a visitor. We learn to allow sadness in. We open the door, and we welcome her, and we sit with her for a while, maybe let her cry a bit, and eventually, when we allow her to cry and express herself and get it out, she eventually leaves. She's not going to stay, right? But if we pretend that we don't see her, you know, cover our eyes, I don't see you, and lock her out, she's going to mope around the house and peek in all our windows and just generally be annoying. You know, she's going to camp out on her doorstep and wail and pound on the door and generally make our lives miserable if we don't acknowledge her. The Buddha also taught through the First Noble Truth that there's not a single person in the world, not one person, who can escape from sadness, from suffering, which is dukkha. Not one of us, right? So again, it's human, it's natural, and it's a fundamental characteristic of the way we lead our lives. And so this is so helpful to remember whenever we're experiencing sadness or any of the emotions, is that we're not alone. So helpful to remember. You know, this remembering can sometimes pop us out of that little cocoon of self, our own personal, you know, circle of sadness that we put ourselves in, and can help us to feel more connected and less separate. So you might start to notice that often sadness arrives when there is a kind of change in our lives. Think about it. Sadness is very intimately hooked on to grief. And so a relationship ends. Someone dies. We're fired from a job, right? We become ill, which is a change. There's a disaster or a tragedy, or, you know, we can even have sadness when there's a big change in our belief system, something that rocks our belief system. Whoa. Then we have to grieve the old way of thinking, actually, even if it's a good thing that your belief system was knocked, the rug was knocked out from under you. You have to grieve. Or maybe we have sort of an epiphany about something. That can actually oftentimes bring sadness, right? And the reason change is often so sad is that it always involves some kind of a loss. So again, sadness is intimately hooked onto grief. So start to notice that whenever you're sad. Am I grieving something? Is there some kind of a loss? Name it, right? You might recall the Buddha's teachings on suffering here, and we suffer, again, mostly because of the truth of anicca, impermanence, right? Change. Life, ourselves, all of it, everything we experience is actually constantly never-ending change. So we are always, if you think about it in essence, saying goodbye to what was. Always, every day, every moment, we're saying goodbye to what was, which means that we will inevitably be faced with grief and sadness, even though we all, if we're honest, really want to avoid this. You know, we tend to all want to avoid change. You might also check that out, right? Aging. Remember when you were a kid and you really wanted to get old? What happened to that? You know. So, you know, just like that 11-year-old in the movie, we all tend to want to stay safe and cozy in our familiar homes, not have to move away and face the possibility of change. You know, we might all want to stay 11, too, and not have to grow up. And I find it really helpful to know that grief is an actual physical process that our brain goes through after a significant change. So the limbic system in our brain holds an internal image of life as we know it. And so whenever change takes place, the new neural pathways must be built to accommodate an updated version of our reality. This is what happens. And so sadness is actually really powerful because it can introduce a crack in our limited and limiting version of reality, right? It can offer that. So we thought it was one way, we believed it was one way, but now it's not that way anymore. Or it was never that way to begin with, but we just believed that it was, okay? For instance, you might go for years or even decades with some relationship that isn't working, right? Or maybe a belief about yourself or your life that isn't working. And once you allow yourself to feel the sadness, you might then allow a new reality to see things in a new light. Right? You have to grieve, though. It's new. So building this new picture of reality quite literally takes a lot of energy and time for the brain to process, depending on the nature of the change. So if we don't understand that grieving is a necessary process in order to move forward, we might become impatient and want to skip this step and this unpleasant period of time, of sadness, of grief. We might want to skip it, right? But from an actual survival perspective, if you'll stay with me, science has suggested that sadness was hardwired into us to keep us safe after significant loss. Is that interesting? So you might begin to notice that sadness is associated with a feeling of heaviness, right? Start to really notice this in your body when you're sad. What is it like? Get to know it. There's a heaviness. There might be a sense of sleepiness or I don't want to get up, right? Drowsiness, heaviness, a withdrawal from activity and social connections. When we're sad, we want to stay home and hibernate, you know? This withdrawal makes more sense when you consider that grief or the time that your brain is updating new information actually causes these things: impaired short-term memory, decreased concentration and attention span, absent-mindedness, forgetfulness, and distraction. And so in primitive times, if you experienced a major loss, it would really, truly be unsafe for you to go hunting and gathering, right? Because your brain would be, you know, absent-minded, forgetful, distracted, you know, lack of short-term memory, concentration, etc. At the same time, then, it's very natural for us to feel afraid or vulnerable when we're feeling sad. This is one of the reasons we don't like it, because there's also fear attached to it. So from a primitive perspective, if it wasn't safe for us to go hunting and gathering, it was a real threat to our actual very survival, right? So it's very natural, again, for us to feel unsafe. You might even recognize these words that we often use to describe sadness: exposed, naked, raw. You know, you might even experience that sense of, if I let myself feel this, I really feel like I'm going to die. I hear that a lot. I can't. I'm going to die if I let myself feel this. So today we need to remind ourselves sometimes that we've evolved, you know, that our minds have evolved, and that even though it's unpleasant, we can actually survive sadness. It's not going to kill us, right? So allowing and really getting to know our sadness, the actual physical sensation of sadness, means that we are slowly becoming aware that it is simply an emotion. It is not who we are. We don't have to slap an identity on it. It's not who we are. And not only can we survive sadness, it can actually be our greatest teacher if we let it, if we allow it. And there are many ways that it can be our teacher. Okay. So it's a signal that we are processing something that we don't want to let go of, usually. A person, a situation, an idea or a belief system that we've held on to so tightly. And this includes, of course, an idea of ourselves, an image of who we think we are as an identity, letting go of that. That's really hard. And that's what the practice is all about, letting go of that. sadness can also really help us clarify what we value, right? So we might not even have seen it before or recognized how much we valued something until we need to let go of it or until we lose it. We don't realize that, oh, I really valued that particular person or belief or thing. And it's important to remember that when we see our wants and needs, we don't need to judge these. Of course, we want things to be different. It's okay. But to get through it, we need to grieve and come to accept a new reality, the truth of how it is now, knowing that that too can and will change. That new reality, FYI, is also going to change. I think I've shared in here before that my husband is a real aficionado of movies, old art movies in particular. But one of his favorites is The Matrix. How many of you have seen The Matrix? Almost everybody? Okay. So most of you know it's this crew of people who have, in a way, awakened from a made-up dream world or fantasy world, and they now live in this old sort of cramped spaceship called Nebuchadnezzar. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And my husband was telling me that he would rather live on Nebuchadnezzar than in a fake reality in a world that's totally just fantasy. And when I think about this, it really feels true to me. I would much rather confront the raw reality, the realness of whatever I'm experiencing, whatever's here, than trying to create or live in a world that's not real. Right, that's constantly happy, not real. So sadness also has the power to help us break through to this realness, if you will, and open our hearts, and therefore become more human, less like a robot. You know, the teacher Sharon Salzberg tells us, something happens when we don't resist, when we don't hate ourselves for what we're experiencing. Our hearts open, and we realize that we are not alone in our suffering. Even the suffering we begin to see is a vehicle for a larger sense of connection to all of life. Once we have that, we have faith. Once we have that, we have faith. As the teachings show us, when we develop the courage to touch and be with our own pain and suffering, what happens is that we can then touch and be with the pain and suffering of others and the world. And we begin to see that our suffering is the same. It's the same. And we're not separate. Suffering is actually a common thread that unites all of us, the whole of humanity, all sentient beings actually, right? And when we recognize the truth, this simple truth, a profound feeling of interconnection can arise. And it can sometimes just bring unspeakable joy, since it counteracts our deepest suffering, our deepest wounding, which is a sense of feeling separate. Okay? And this is the way that sadness can actually bring joy. If we allow sadness, it actually produces joy. It's a paradox. It connects us. It opens our hearts and it makes us human. When we're denying our own sadness, it means that we're also denying and not able to see or respect or know the sadness that other people are also experiencing. Right? And when we can really be with our own sadness without any judgment, not judging it, it helps us to be able to develop and practice true compassion, which, by the way, is the opposite of pity, compassion. Pity is toxic, right? Because it tends to separate us. There's not that I have the same suffering. It's like, whoa, your suffering is so much worse than mine. You know. To quote Pema again, compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It is a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness well can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity. And so just like in the movie, Joy finally recognizes that sadness is not at all beneath her or someone annoying, someone she needs to change or judge or keep locked in a circle. Sadness is a totally equal and very powerful partner. I love that about that movie. It's true. So finally, I'll end with another teaching from Pema, mostly because I just love this and her, and it speaks to the intimate partnership of joy and sorrow. She says, life is glorious. Life is glorious, but it is also wretched. It's both. Appreciating the gloriousness inspires us, encourages us, cheers us up, gives us a bigger perspective, energizes us. We feel connected. But if that's all that's happening, we get arrogant and start to look down on others, and there's a sense of making ourselves a big deal and being really serious about it, wanting it to be like that forever. The gloriousness becomes tinged by craving and addiction. On the other hand, wretchedness, life's painful aspects, softens us up considerably. Knowing pain is a very important ingredient for being there for another person. When you are feeling a lot of grief, you can look right into somebody's eyes because you feel you haven't got anything to lose. You're just there. The wretchedness humbles us and softens us, but if we were only wretched, we would all just go down the tubes. We'd be so depressed, discouraged, and hopeless that we wouldn't have enough energy to eat an apple. Gloriousness and wretchedness need each other. One inspires us. The other softens us. They go together. Yeah. So I think I'm going to end there and invite you all to settle just for a moment, a couple minutes. So just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. And breathing right into the heart. You can imagine the shape of the heart. And those of you who would like to, as always, can place a hand or both hand on the heart, hands on the heart. Offering the heart some kindness. And even right now, to see if you can invite an allowing to whatever's here in the heart right now, whatever it is. And tap into that, see what's here in this moment. And you might inquire if there's any kind of hurt or vulnerability, grief, sadness that you haven't fully allowed to be here. Just notice how your relationship is with your heart when it comes to sadness or grief or hurt. What have you been saying to your heart? Really be honest. What have you been saying to your heart or to yourself about your sadness or grief or hurt? Would it be possible to listen to your heart, to what it has to say, to what it has to feel, to the wisdom of your heart? Is it possible to bow deeply to your heart, remembering what a powerful partner your heart is. What does it want to say? Just listen. What you might want to consider, what would you like to say to your heart after listening to your heart? What would you like to say to your heart? And finally, just listening to these words from Maya Luna, who I heard about recently after listening to this talk, wonderful talk by Tanisara Mary Weinberg. She writes, "When you fail, don't be so quick to dust yourself off with pep talks meant to get you to rise up triumphantly and explain, 'I'm not giving up.' Don't be triumphant. Instead, give up. That's right, give up. Not forever, but just for now, just for a moment at least, just give up. Give it all up. You will be tempted to comfort yourself with spiritual concepts meant to assure you this is all for the best. This is all part of a grand plan to cleanse you, purify you, make you triumphant, glorious, heroic. No, don't do this. Don't be a hero. But also, do not be devoured by shame, by self-hatred. This is just the same game played backwards. No, just give up. Just for a moment. Just stay low. Low to the ground, your false self shattered. Breathe the grass, taste the dew, inhale the soil. You failed, you broke, life broke. Kiss the brokenness and receive your true self hidden in the spaces in between."